Case today is case number 57928, State versus Beckman. We have Mr. Lowe and Ms. Kilpatrick for day number two.
It's deja vu.
And there's no reply brief here, so just no rebuttal.
Thank you.
Hey, police court. Robert J. Lowe, Deputy District Attorney, Elko County. Justice Pickering asked yesterday if something stimulated a thought, and it was a question about whether Judge Mayo considered the trooper's veracity or reliability or words to that effect when he made his decision. And unfortunately, it was a negative thought, considering the trooper. And I spoke to counsel about it afterwards, and we were having a little bite to eat. And I mentioned to her apparently long ago that there was an issue and I was concerned about. So I had some time. I stopped in at the Office of Professional Responsibility for the DPS and checked. And I talked to Linda Anderson there, and the receptionist, and she had Lieutenant Jackie Muth call me, and she's the commander of the Office of Professional Responsibility. And what I recall is that they told me that she told me that there was sort of an agency assist from Twin Falls, Idaho, where Trooper Pickers was applying for a job. And to make a long story short, what I believe she told me was that Trooper Pickers made statements that were misleading and/or dishonest in his application. And even though he left the employ of the NHP or DPS on his own accord, those statements would have been enough to result in his termination. And I apologize for not pointing that out yesterday, but I didn't want to slander anybody, and the matter had been tucked away in my mind, but there you have it. I hope I've disclosed my duties of candor to this court. Well, let's see. An issue came up yesterday as well about, I'm afraid it was Justice Pickering as well, but whether the police need any kind of suspicion to, it may have been somebody else, I don't remember, but whether they need any kind of suspicion to run the drug dog. And the answer that I gave yesterday was no. And we have to stand by that. And I checked my notes, and I found a couple of U.S. Supreme Court cases, U.S. v. Place, 462 U.S. 696, Illinois versus Caballes, 125 Supreme Court, 834, 2005, and U.S. v. Jacobson, 466 U.S. 109.
Could you read those sites again, please?
Yes, Your Honor. U.S. v. Place, 462 U.S. 696, Illinois v. Caballes, C-A-B-A-L-L-E-S, 125 Supreme Court, 834, 2005, and U.S. v. Jacobson, 466 U.S. 109. And Jacobson is involves Federal Express, and it's less so, but they do summarize, I think, that a drug dog reveals nothing more than whether the suspect contained, whether his luggage, whatever, contains any contraband that this person has no right to possess, and so it's not.
I understand that. In this case, let me help you focus on what is of concern to me. Though, again, we're departing a bit from the exigency issue teed up by the briefs, but this case, even more clearly than yesterday's case, seems to present an issue where the driver of the car was stopped, his license was checked. He was told he would just be warned for going 72 and a 65. Trooper Pickers attempts to prolong the duration of the stop so Duchess, the drug dog, can arrive. The man is ready to leave. The driver of the car, Beckman, is ready to leave and wants to, and the drug dog has not arrived yet. There's a period of time in there from 7:21 to 7:27 or whatever it is, where Duchess is not there, and there is no basis to detain Mr. Beckman. my question to you is, how is that consistent with the Fourth Amendment? They've seized Mr. Beckman at that point, yet the incident for which he was stopped was determined to be not citation-worthy.
A great question, but a question that unfortunately is not before the court because Judge Mayo didn't rule on that.
Right.
Drug dog arrives 7:21. The sniff is at 7:30, and the dog alerts at 7:31. So there is a 10-minute
period.
And the
dog did its job completely. The dog created probable cause at this point. The dog did a good job.
But there is that period of time of 9-10 minutes where Mr. Beckman is detained, but it wasn't ruled upon by the district court, and these should be...
But that was asserted. It was simply acknowledged but not ruled upon by Judge Mamea, correct?
Correct.
And what was the state's defense to that point? Or what is the state's defense? If let's say we say, you know, there was sufficient exigency or exigency is not required, but this needs to go back for that issue. What would you say on that issue?
Well, it's a seizure, obviously. He's been seized, but it's a brief detention. And it's justified by the... all of the reasonable suspicion that, Trooper Pickers saw, the excessive nervousness. He was dropping documents. He was offering him wine. At the suppression motion, the defense says, well, he's a wine merchant. He's just trying to drum up business. He gave him his card. He's trying to drum up a business. It's natural. You know, he's offering him wine.
He had handprints on his trunk.
Excessive amount of...
And he was physically fit?
Well, I'm not sure how the physically fit fits into it. You'd think that would cut the other way. It seems
right.
that drug people would be less than physically fit, but I don't know. Shoot.
Could it be a factual issue as to reasonable suspicion for the additional detention? That would be your position, that it would need to be explored factually?
Exactly. And... there's Sergeant George who arrives and who's a 10-year veteran and says this guy is very nervous. So it's not just Trooper Pickerson, you know.
But the Sergeant George arrives after Mr. Beckman has said to Trooper Pickers, may I leave now? And Trooper Pickers says, absolutely not. And Mr. Beckman says, well, why are you keeping me?
True, but...
I mean, I would be nervous also.
I don't want to presume to think what you think, but I presume you'd be irate more than nervous and saying,
me.
Well, wait a minute, you told me I was going to get a warning, and now you're waiting for a drug dog, but a person who's carrying contraband would be nervous. So, let's see. So my point is, I guess, that the police can sniff, have the drug dog sniff cars at random or all cars in a parking lot or whatever, and it's not a search within the Fourth Amendment. And
so if Trooper Picker had a drug dog in his car and deployed the drug dog when he stopped and the dog had hit, there would be no problem.
No problem. And our second argument on this issue is it's a... not a very long period out of Mr. Beckman's life, a 9 or 10 minute period. Although it is a detention, it's extremely brief, and Trooper Pickers is, throughout the whole period, acting expeditiously to get the dog there. He calls several times, where's the dog? Where's the dog? Let's get the dog here. So there is going to be a little bit of time when you're going to have to get the dog out there, and especially in a large county like Elko, it's not going to happen immediately. Now, granted, this happened right downtown on the highway, 301, I think, on the exit, so it's real close. But to the police department, and the officer that responded was a city police officer, I believe it was Officer Lowry. So in any case, it was a de minimis intrusion, this brief seizure while they waited for the drug dog to arrive, is what our secondary argument would be. And the Supreme Court has approved de minimis things like this and forcing people to get out of their car, starting off with the driver and then the passengers and DUI roadblocks, which we don't let the police do in Elko, although they've been approved by the U.S. Supreme Court because we feel it violates the spirit of the Constitution, if not the letter. In any case, our second argument, of course, is this issue about the exclusionary rule. If you don't mind me beating a dead horse, I know there's no point to it except for the sheer joy of it. But the exclusionary rule, we've heard, should not, from the Supreme Court in Herring and Davis, it's not a but-for thing. If you have an error, you simply don't apply the exclusionary rule automatically. You have to look and see if the level of culpability of the police and weigh that against the enormous social costs. And the enormous social costs the Supreme Court of the United States is talking about is what happens when we exclude excellent, reliable evidence and a criminal goes free. And the bottom line is it breeds disrespect for the criminal law, it breeds disrespect for the system, and the courts, the people don't understand it. And the substantial social cost of in a case like this, where the law is far from clear on this automobile exception, where there's two lines of cases, and you can see the transcript where Judge Romeo and I have this colloquy about whether it's, as he says, a continuum, or I say it's two lines of different cases that are completely different, and it's far from clear. It doesn't make any sense to exclude evidence where the cops are trying their best to follow the guidance of the court. And in Davis, this recent case I cited yesterday from the U.S. Supreme Court, they're talking about good faith reliance on an appellate court. And what happened was the Belton rule is still in effect in Davis, and it was overturned, of course. And the Supreme Court says it doesn't make any sense to apply the exclusionary rule. And it doesn't teach the police anything. In order to overturn, there should be something that teaches the police a lesson. And they should say, the court should say, well, this is clear that it's everybody knew this rule, and we're going to exclude the evidence. Otherwise, the police, they come away with, it's so confusing, no one could understand it, lawyers are confused, judges are overturned. It's got to be a clear state of the law before we overturn anything, where suppression doesn't result in any kind of appreciable deterrence, exclusion is not warranted. The deterrent value of the exclusionary rule depends on the culpability of the police, and in this case, it's hard to say that Trooper Pickers had any culpability at all. He's trying to follow the law, and he stopped a car. There's a driver in it. It's on the roadside. This falls along the Fletcher and Hughes line of cases where there's very little that's required as far as exigency. If you follow Fletcher and Hughes...
What to do with the argument your opponent makes that Trooper Pickers manufactured the exigency and that under Kentucky versus King... we should discredit the exigency argument as a result. In other words, that he created it. Manufactured is too strong a word, but that he, by his actions, created it.
I don't think he did. I mean, he stopped a car for speeding, and then he sees somebody who's extremely nervous and fits this criteria, I guess, of a drug trafficker. And so... He didn't manufacture any kind of emergency. It's just in the normal course of business.
Okay.
So I would say that the court, if there's any heart at all to overturning this issue of the emergency requirement in the auto exception, that it would be something that would square the cases. It's a bitter pill, the Supreme Court says, this exclusionary rule. That's the last resort, not the first impulse. So unless there's a weighing and balancing of the social cost against what's going to be learned by the police, there's no point in applying the exclusionary rule, even if there is an error. And the most thing to tell the Trooper Pickers is that was he negligent? But based on the case law, which is admittedly confusing, at least from my point of view, Trooper Pickers did the best he could. And so there's no reason to apply the exclusionary rule. But another point, Trooper Pickers could have simply told Mr. Beckman, walk on, we have enough here now to take your car, and we'll bring the drug dog off out and run it around. And he could have left him on the side of the road there while they ran the drug dog, or he could have told him to go. He could have excluded him with this reasonable suspicion. And I think that's in place as well, that when there's reasonable suspicion, an item can be seized for a brief period of time. You can seize items with reasonable suspicion and continue your investigation.
Thank you very much.
Any questions? I'll shut up.
Mrs. Kilpatrick, for the respondent.
Thank you for your argument.
May it please the court. I would like to start off by addressing what Justice Pickering brought up about what I see as essentially putting the cart before the horse. If we read the opinion that Judge Mamea wrote, he said, there's probable cause because the dog alerted, and the question just becomes exigency. The problem with that is he says, well, since there was no exigency, I'm not going to address whether or not there was probable cause. But in the paragraph above, he says, yeah, there's a detainer issue. The district court heard that issue, but just decided to jump to exigency before probable cause. It was written in the original motion to suppress. It was the primary issue, because you can't have exigency without probable cause. I can't think of a situation where you would. So the problem is the circular logic. Well, the reason why the dog hit is because there was this 15 minutes. And if you actually look at the tape and you count the time between the time that Trooper Pickers first asked for a drug dog and the time it came, it was 15 minutes. And when Mr. Beckman tries to leave, he says, you are not free to leave. That's not a detention. That is an arrest. That's not de minimis. That is, I am requiring you to sit here and wait. And there was absolutely nothing to even base the lowest form of detention, like, you know, a Terry detention. The factors that were listed were mind-boggling. I mean, an interesting fact of note is, you know, Pickers talks about how, oh gosh, there are all these handprints on the trunk. Yeah, well, there weren't any drugs actually found in the trunk. The wine that he dealt was in the trunk. So if you're lifting your trunk to get a bottle of wine, then you're going to be putting your hands on your trunk a lot. Anyone is nervous when they get questioned by police. The fact that Pickers was offered a bottle of wine, I don't see how that's an issue here, because Pickers tells Beckman, hey, thank you, I'm going to give you a warning, keep it nice and keep it short, or, you know, keep it, you know, at the speed limit. And Mr. Beckman says, hey, here's my card, have a bottle of wine. I fail to see the state's logic and how that creates any form of articulable suspicion whatsoever at all. So that's a major problem with the opinion, but I'd like, that was not addressed in the actual brief, but it was addressed in the court below. I'd like to talk about some of the other things.
That was the lead issue in the motion to suppress, correct?
I'm sorry?
That was the lead issue in the motion to suppress,
right? It was. I'd like to talk briefly about some of the distinguishing characteristics between this case and yesterday's case that make this noticeably different. First off, the tow truck arrives. The exigency that is created when a auto stop occurs and the car is left unattended, as described in Fletcher and Hughes, turns in on itself just by looking at this case. The tow truck arrives a half hour after its call, after the drug dog does, and when the tow truck arrives, they're still searching the vehicle. So the logic of it's an exigent circumstance because we can't waste our police to have it on the side of the road makes absolutely no sense. And I would ask this court to reconsider the logic of the exigency that is discussed in those two cases, because not only is it, has it
doesn't
been...
Doesn't that ultimately lead to the conclusion, perhaps, that the exigent circumstances prong of Nevada law really shouldn't exist, that we should go to the federal standard altogether? I was taken by your remark yesterday. What do we serve by the rationale that police should not have to wait by the side of the road while they, for the tow truck to arrive? And your point that, well, then the evidentiary scene is not secure during that period where they drive off and leave it there and the tow truck isn't there and nobody's there. But to me, the argument then really militates in favor of saying, should Nevada maintain the Harnisch line of cases, at least as interpreted more broadly in some of, like Camacho and some of the others?
I would say no, and this is an excellent example of why. After the dog alerts, this search isn't just a search. This isn't just, you know, looking around the car. You see pickers with tools taking apart the vehicle. He's taking apart the bumper. He's taking apart the airbags. He's taking apart the speakers. He physically goes in the trunk head first, okay? And as we saw yesterday with Mr. Lloyd, all of his personal belongings are being tossed on the sidewalk while onlookers are pointing. We have to talk about the harm here, okay? That is what we're trying to prevent. Someone's vehicle being completely destroyed, and how far are they allowed to go when they search? So if the drug dog hits and they, you know, didn't find the drugs in the coffee can, does that mean they can slice up the seats? Does that mean they can take a razor blade to the carpeting? I mean, how far does that go? I mean, and then when they don't find anything, you know, who pays for the damage? It's the level of potential harm on a citizen is great. And the reason why we need a warrant additionally is because an independent magistrate can then review the credentials of the dog. In order to make the warrant even effective, one would have to put in the warrant, this dog is nationally certified, this dog is trained, I have allowed this dog to detect various odors, I have allowed this dog to compare the residual odor versus odor that's present. I mean, I submit to this court that if a dog is not properly trained in residual odor versus actual odor, a dog's going to hit on every car in an Avis parking lot or any rental car parking lot because of the amount of drugs that, you know, can come in and out of rental cars. I mean, a good citizen just picked up a car from an airport, is speeding, and all of a sudden they're going to get their rental car, like, cut up and tossed and torn apart because a dog hits on it. That's why this needs to be reviewed by a magistrate. It's because of the potential harm. And that's what we've seen in these particular cases. A fact that was before this court in this particular case as opposed to yesterday's is the trooper testified that a telephonic warrant was not available. Interesting also is that today's case and yesterday's case are exactly a week apart. This case occurred on November 1st. Yesterday's case is on November 8th, both of which were a Sunday, exactly 1 week apart, same officer. The telephonic warrant ability has been in the NRS since 1981. The 179.045 added subsection 2 in there, which says, it doesn't say telephone per se, it says, in lieu of an affidavit required by subsection 1, the magistrate may take an oral statement given under oath, which must be recorded in the presence of the magistrate or in the magistrate's immediate vicinity by a certified court reporter or by electronic means. So to say that a telephonic search warrant was not available, well, there's either a problem with the Elko judiciary, or there's a problem with effort on the part of the trooper. And I would submit that it's the latter as opposed to the former. Our judiciary is incredibly accessible. And just because he couldn't get a telephonic warrant doesn't mean he couldn't get a warrant. I mean, we live in a very small town where everyone knows where everyone lives. I mean, there's nothing stopping him from going up to the Justice of the Peace's door. I mean, RJP even has held court on Saturday. Well, he's now a district court judge. But there's no effort at all to get a warrant in here. And that's also an issue. In addition to the potential damage and the telephonic warrant issue that was raised in this case, with regard to the state's argument with the Herring and the Herring and Davis line of cases, that is such a slippery slope to go down to say that we're not going to apply the exclusionary rule. The Davis case concerned an officer that used Belton rules before Gant was ruled upon. So the issue came before the Supreme Court as to whether or not the officer acted inappropriately, but at the time of the search in that case, he did. He acted the way he was supposed to. Then later on, the court came down with Gant. So I believe that by saying we're not going to exclude the evidence, not only puts us down a slippery slope, it's just a vertical slope made of ice. I mean,
well, that may be true, counsel, but the Supreme Court has, by those cases, modified the exclusionary rule. We have not said, to my knowledge, that Nevada's constitution guides a separate exclusionary rule. We adopt and incorporate the exclusionary rule as interpreted by the United States Supreme Court. So at least since those cases have been decided, it would seem as though our exclusionary rule analysis has to include, and a district judge's exclusionary rule analysis has to include, the culpability of the officer.
Well, I think you're
which gets to the question that I raised with Mr. Lowe yesterday. In this area, if the law is so confusing, it seems difficult to require officers to. It almost forces us to default to the new exclusionary rule, and raises serious questions about the exclusion or admissibility of evidence. And I don't think these issues should be decided on the U.S. Supreme Court jurisprudence, as slippery a slope and as icebergy as it may be. We ought to get our jurisprudence sound so that people aren't unfairly searched in the first place.
I agree that we definitely need sound jurisprudence in this area, but the glaring distinguishing factor between Herring and Davis and Leon is we're talking about an innocent mistake on the part of the cop that wasn't his own, okay? With Leon, we're talking about a warrant that when the law enforcement officer served it, it was facially valid. It wasn't his mistake, okay?
Yeah, but I just don't think that the U.S. Supreme Court intended to limit the change in the exclusionary rule to the facts of that case. I think they were announcing a qualification of the rule.
Right, but I think that the Supreme Court did make a distinction between something that is innocent and something that's a judgment call. Because in Herring, we're talking about essentially a data entry problem with regard to removing an arrest warrant. A judgment call in the field is completely different. And with regard to the officer's culpability, I would say, well, that's present here too. The officer was culpable in a completely unlawful and unreasonable detention in this case. And in the case of yesterday, just absolutely no respect at all for anyone's privacy. And as we can see through looking at both tapes, we've got an officer yesterday coming up and taking a picture for his scrapbook. And in this case, we've got the officer. You can hear him talk to the person in his ride-along saying, yeah, man, there's several indicators in here, and I'll tell you what they are, before he gets out of the vehicle. So if there's evidence before this court that Trooper Pickers acted with some culpability, I believe that given some of the egregious circumstances in this case, it does. One of the reasons that he said, and he testified to in this case, that you know he believed he had reasonable suspicion was because drugs move west to east. That is so constitutionally egregious. That's like stopping someone for saying, I don't like your face. I mean, it is outrageous to say, well, you know, it's nighttime, and he was driving, you know, from California. He was going eastbound at night. That's unconscionable. And to use that as some sort of suspicion to take tools and tear up someone's car, I think that we've got a level of culpability here. But I think there needs to be a distinction with how we look at the exclusionary rule between something that's not the officer's mistake, it's someone else's, versus what the judgment call actually is in the field. Because if there's no exclusion for judgment call made in the field, well, you know, I did the best I could. It looked like reasonable suspicion to me.
Well, but does the maintenance of this elusive distinctions on exigent circumstances in Nevada's automobile law, does that in and of itself, given the new U.S. Supreme Court jurisprudence, suggest that it would be well advised for Nevada, which has no court of appeals, nobody except for us to write about this, not to maintain this sort of one-off jurisprudence on under Harnish? In other words, we're interjecting confusion, and the U.S. Supreme Court, and I take your point about whether it's his fault or judgment call in the field versus somebody else's mistake, but by maintaining a difficult and elusive distinction that is not, you know, the people out there cannot draw on federal jurisprudence to find answers to these questions. They have to scrutinize Harnish and Fletcher and Hughes and Camacho and those cases and try to figure out how that applies in this setting. Doesn't that kind of argue in favor that we should shift back to a clearer, more accessible body of law?
I believe we definitely should create a clearer, more accessible body of law, and I hope that that's going to be the result of why we're here today. Another large distinction between the Supreme Court jurisprudence regarding the exclusionary rule and a situation like this is we're talking about a totality test as opposed to like a single rule type of thing. When you're talking about taking probable cause, I mean, probable cause and exigency, the admissibility of a confession, there's jurisprudence within our state that says that those are all totality issues. And you can't make a bright line rule regarding totality issues. That's what we've always said. So I think that's the distinction. And I don't think that we can say that, you know, we're just going to toss exigency, because then what are we going to that goes down a slippery slope because of the fact that there is no one factor that is solely determinative.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you both for 2 days of excellent presentations, and this matter will stand submitted.
Thank you.
We're recessed 11:30.